Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
On this episode, it is a bit of a hodgepodge of some awards afterthought films, awards that the studios thought they would be competitive, but are actually ending up as also-rans.
Mm-hmm.
We actually didn't see the biggest blockbusters of the week. We didn't see Mortal Engines. We didn't see The Mule, not because of us, but because of Clint Eastwood. He's not screening The Mule.
I don't think he screened his last one either, so no. It's all making me a little suspicious.
Yeah, his last one was 1517 to Paris.
Right.
He did not screen that. And we didn't see Mary, Queen of Scots. We didn't see Spider-Man, which is going to be the biggest film of the week.
And to give Spider-Man a little plug, though, everyone who's seen it has told me that that they think it's the best animated movie of the year.
I hear the exact same thing, and I am going to take the kid to it this weekend or the next one. But so what could that possibly leave us, Hannah, to talk about? Well, we did see still quite a few of them, but they're more in limited release.
And I'm just going to say that I did not see Mary, Queen of Scots kind of on purpose because I felt like I had already filled my personal quota of period dramas with The Favorite and with Outlaw King. So I don't feel like I really needed to see Mary, Queen of Scots as well.
And they're all related, Outlaw King.
Mm-hmm.
Is related to Mary, Queen of Scots, who is related to Queen Anne.
Exactly. So I saw two out of three.
They're all related.
Exactly. Yeah.
So the first one we're going to talk about is called Vox Lux. And it's already brave because of the title. The title's in Latin. The writer-director Brady Corbett titled it in Latin for Voice of Light. And the voice we're talking about is Celeste. Celeste. This movie's entirely about Celeste. It's about her high school, like one day in the life of high school. And then jump 17 years later, and when she is an international mega pop star. So it's two films, Hannah,
mm-hmm.
In one. And they feel deliberately screwed together with like scotch tape.
Well, and I think, you know, it's a Natalie Portman movie, but she doesn't show up till the second half. And I think the trailer really only deals with the second half, and people are going to think they're going to see this kind of offbeat movie musical, and that's not the case at all. The first half deals with a tragedy that then leads into this girl's career as a pop star. And so it's two very different films from part one to part two.
Yeah, the whole movie is about 110 minutes, and I don't know, maybe the first half's only 45. It felt a little shorter than the second half. Celeste in the beginning is played by Raffi Cassidy. She's now going to make my list of top five youth performers of the year. It's a very moving performance, and she's involved. She's a victim of a school shooting. Her entire music class is gunned down by a boy, and she survives. She gets shot in the neck, which is kind of a thing for the rest of the film with how she dresses. But to get past that, some therapy is she pens a song with her sister Eleanor, played by Stacey Martin. They write a song together, and it explodes. It's actually a very good song. It's called Wrapped Up, and Raffi Cassidy, I've been listening to it on Spotify. Raffi Cassidy sings a version, and Natalie Portman sings a version. And I think I like Natalie's better, but it's a very good song, and you should really check it out. And then it jumps, really hard. You get the note on the screen that says 17 years later, and Natalie Portman is manic. She is pop megastar. This is day one, night one of her new extravaganza concert. She's playing Staten Island, her hometown, and she's got this thick Staten Island accent. And it's just kind of like almost a day in the life of someone who has no privacy. She has a public persona and no other persona. Her manager is Jude Law,
mm-hmm.
who is part manager, part psychiatrist, part drug supplier. Eleanor, the sister, is still around, but they have a strained relationship. Her daughter is now played again by Raffi Cassidy. Interesting casting there.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to get across is Vox Lux is insane at times. And you're going to think about it when you walk out. And it's also the second movie this year that ends on a 20-minute concert. The songs are mostly by Sia. They're pretty good. They're
mm-hmm.
not great.
They're
pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed this film. I got so much out of it.
It's an odd sell, though. I don't think a lot of people are going to know what they're walking into. It's got, without a doubt, it was the most shocking opening 10 minutes of a film that I could imagine seeing at the holiday season. It really is. It's sort of a reminder of what was happening with like the Parkland school shooting and what happened in the aftermath of Columbine. And it was really this whole school shooting that marks the first half of the film really was kind of in that, meant to be in that era, like really in that post-Columbine era. And that whole wave of how social media things just take off so quickly, so that this character and her sister, Celeste and her sister, you know, sing this song at a memorial service. And that's really what goes viral and turns her into this superstar who obviously never really got over some of these major issues of her youth and because she was thrust into the limelight. But this is more of a Natalie Portman a la Black Swan than it is your Natalie Portman of Jackie. So it's really important for folks to understand the difference that this is an R-rated movie and that the second half has that music component that is kind of fun to watch that concert at the end. But everything that leads up to it, it's a very disturbing movie.
I remember when I was done, I texted you and I said, I can't believe this is the same actress who just played Jackie Kennedy or was even in Annihilation earlier this year. Neither Brady Corbett, Natalie Portman, nor Jude Law will say Celeste is based on any real-life person, but it is. It's an amalgamation, I believe, of Madonna, Britney Spears, and a splash of Lady Gaga.
Oh, and a little David Bowie was thrown in there, too. That look, her style.
The glam look, the sleek metallic look on her hair, and the costumes are extraordinary. And it's the second half. He doesn't really have a consistent message throughout the film, but the second half is about the current state of affairs in the world, mm-hmm. and pop megalomania maybe is looking through that prism of it. At one point, Celeste says, it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what you say. No one cares. And she has done some terrible things in her life. Terrible things. She's been a bad mother.
Mom.
She's not even just
sister.
The divorce is the least of it. She's still addicted to certain narcotics. She's kind of an awful person to be around most of the time. But it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but this is definitely, it's a provocative film and it is more experimental. I mean, I can see why you really liked it, but it's definitely skews more arty than mainstream for what's delivered. Although the trailer, I think, will mislead some people into seeing something that's very different from what they get. And Natalie Portman, though, I believe she does her own singing, but it's very well produced. So it's heavily produced in the songs that she delivers, but she really can sing. So that was very impressive. And yeah, and the girl who plays her as both the teenage Celeste and the daughter of Celeste, an interesting casting choice. And that was, her role was very impressive. And I thought she did really well, because at first I was like, she looks familiar, and then I realized it was the same actress. In acquired taste, this is not going to be a movie that everyone's going to enjoy.
It's an experiment, but I do think it's an experiment that could connect with audiences if they gave it a chance. I think this is for people that are looking for an edgier Bohemian Rhapsody.
It is that.
I really got a kick out of this film. The next one we're going to talk about is Ben is Back. Familiar subject matter. Hannah, where is Ben coming back from?
Gee, Ben is coming back from rehab, which seems to be a theme in several movies this year. But Ben is played by Lucas Hedges, who we just saw in Boy Erased, and is a really good actor. And his mom in this film is played by Julia Roberts, who's, you know, this is a really good role for her. It's I like this movie way more than you did, I think, because to me, it's one of those addiction family dramas that is a little easier, goes down a little easier than the film Beautiful Boy that we saw a little while back that had Steve Carell as a dad with a son who's an addict, played by Timothy Chalamet. That one was a lot more distressing to watch. And you saw the cycle of addiction a lot more in Beautiful Boy. But with Ben is Back, you're really looking at a 24 hours in the life of a 19-year-old kid who shows up at his house at Christmas time. He's not really supposed to be released from his rehab program just yet. He's 77 days clean, and he essentially has run away to home for Christmas, and his mother makes a deal with him that she will be on his tail and watching his every move and drug testing him for 24 hours. He can stay home for 24 hours through Christmas, and then she will take him back to rehab. And this film is really about what happens in that 24 hours.
Ben Burns should not be home. He claims he's 77 days sober, and I do believe him, and he's living in a halfway house called Sober Living, and there's just too many triggers at home, too many familiar faces, too many familiar scenes. Maybe he still has an old stash or two lying around, because like he explains, as any addict, you should not trust him. He says, do not trust me. Addicts lie. We'll do whatever we can to score, but he's coming home with a message. He says, you'll see, this time will be different. And you get the feeling that he's already had a fifth and sixth time. His stepfather, very well played by Courtney B. Vance, is the most wary, along with his sister, played by Catherine Newton. But he says, you know, if Ben was black, he would either be dead or in prison. And Julia Roberts says, you're right. I absolutely agree with you. Because he's white and affluent and from the suburbs, he gets more lenient punishments than really anybody else. And I like the director, Peter Hedges, which is Lucas Hedges' father. Mm-hmm. Very interesting working dynamic. It must have been on set. He does some quirky things to really take us inside the suburbs now that the opioid epidemic, the drug epidemic crisis, has left the cities and gone into the suburbs. He has a plot device in the second half of the film where the family dog is stolen. Someone stole the dog, and most likely it's someone from Ben's past, some trouble he has caused that is now revisiting them. So they're going, retracing Ben's old life to find this dog, and that's what's taking us into, let's learn about suburban drug crisis. Here's a house where he may have performed some sexual favors. Here's a house of a girl he got hooked on drugs. Here's a house of a guy he used to do favors for. And it's like, okay, we're in the educational portion, and it's shocking his mom. And I thought it was a little cloying, that device. You brought up Beautiful Boy. The timelines are totally different. This is a day in the life of one family suffering. Beautiful Boy is a decade, almost 8 years or so, in the life of one family suffering. I enjoyed Beautiful Boy a lot more than this one. And I don't know, something about Ben Burns and his 24-hour spree just didn't connect with me.
I liked it, but I do feel that Lucas Hedges, Timothy Chalamet, to me, delivered in Beautiful Boy a sort of awards-worthy kind of performance, because you saw him as both an addict and on his clean days, and to watch that transformation that occurs over and over again. You're on this really rough emotional roller coaster with that film. With this one, Lucas Hedges, from his characters in Manchester by the Sea, Three Billboards, and then Boy Erased a little while ago, and now this one, he still always feels like Lucas Hedges to me. Like, his characters don't seem to veer that far off from who he just really personifies as an actor. And so it's sort of variations on a theme for me with him. But I like him. He's so watchable, and I think that's a thing with Julia Roberts, too, is that this movie really is following these two. It's this mother-son dynamic that she knows what she needs to be doing. She knows she can't really trust him, but it's her boy, it's her baby, and she loves him, and she is going to do whatever she can to help him and to make sure that he stays clean. And so you just see that a lot of different emotion out of the Julia Roberts character, and the pain that she's, the conflicting emotions of, do I take him right back to rehab? or can I want him personally. It's selfish that she wants him home for Christmas. And so for the Julia Roberts role, I think this is really one of her strongest roles in quite some time.
Julia Roberts outplayed Lucas Hedges. She really did. And it's because she's kind of she's a mom apologist. It's not Ben's fault that he got hooked to drugs. It must have been the doctor when he was 14 who prescribed him painkillers and then upped his dose. It must have been because she divorced his real father. It can't be Ben's fault. It's some external factor, an external event that drove him into drugs. And Ben is, in their one-on-one scene, is just trying to get through to her, saying, "Mom, it's me. I did this. I'm an addict. Listen to me." And she actually just can't listen to him because she's just too close.
Yeah, but that's, I think, what makes the movie really interesting and makes it more accessible to the suburban crowd and very relatable with the opioid epidemic as it stands right now. And so it does open up to me the potential for dialogue among the teenagers and the parents. And I was shocked that this was rated R because I couldn't really figure out, other than a few F words that are thrown into the mix, it was so much tamer to watch than Beautiful Boy, which was R as well. So I kind of feel like it's okay, as I would almost consider it really PG-13 plus.
It would have been more relatable. In fact, the first half of the film was more relatable than Beautiful Boy. And then it switches gears into that mystery suspense thriller
the
business.
Dog.
And it left what its original intention. It veered off and it went into another territory. That's where it lost me. And that's why it could have been.
It is another one. But just like Vox Lux, I felt like I was watching. Sometimes you feel like you're watching two different movies.
Ben Is Back is not an experiment like Vox Lux was.
It's a much more mainstream type of film and treatment. But that's why I still was in it. I was in the whole sort of mother son trying to find the dog and being together and bonding, and then having to getting lost and finding each other again. And to me, in the end, it all worked. And it did take a turn, but to me, it definitely came back to where it needed to come back to. And it's just a solid movie. I can't imagine, you know, this necessarily breaking through past a whole lot of other movies for awards, but it fits that decent, solid, interesting, well-acted kind of film. But I do feel like Lucas Hedges kind of cancels himself out with these with Boy Erased, where he was in a gay conversion therapy program, and then this one where he's in a drug rehabilitation program. And the characters still very good at heart, like the same kind of guy. And that, to me, I kind of wish they were released a little further apart. And I wish Beautiful Boy had not been released just before this one, too, because I think that one got kind of lost. And they sort of deserve to be out at separate times so that people could just kind of watch them independent of each other.
Well, that's what happens when studios rack and stack what they believe their products will go the furthest come award season, and they both had their backers.
Yeah.
I was so confused by our next film, I didn't go. Because 7 months ago, I remember going to the movie theater and watching Deadpool 2. Deadpool is just infamous now for being this hard R, but very funny, but very overly violent, super anti-hero. Ryan Reynolds is Deadpool. Everybody knows him now because he's had two films. And now we have another one called Once Upon a Deadpool. And I looked at the trailer and was like, wait a minute. So they're saying this is a PG-13 Deadpool 2, which immediately just sounds awful. And it's got some Fred Savage in it. But you took the plunge. You said, I got to do this. I'm going to go see it. What is going on?
Well, apparently it's really kind of a stunt. So they're releasing this film for 12 days over the Christmas holiday and actually giving a portion of it, $1 per ticket sold, to the, they're calling it Fudge Cancer Organization, which actually the F word is slightly different in the real name of this cancer research organization. But so the proceeds, some of them are going to a very good cause. And the premise, this is admittedly a rehash and a retread of Deadpool 2. But what they do is they frame it in this very funny kind of context where Fred Savage, Deadpool essentially kidnaps Fred Savage. And there's this homage to the 1987 bedtime story classic, The Princess Bride. And so Deadpool is basically then reading to Fred Savage the story of what happened in Deadpool 2. And so that really is, that frames this sanitized version of events that occurred in the original movie, which had that kid that you really liked, Ricky Biker
from the Wilder People.
Yeah. And so...
Because I saw Deadpool 2, I remember.
So you know, he remembered Deadpool 2. But this is... But it's just a fun revisit.
Is it a cash grab?
Yeah, of course. Well, but it's a cash grab with a cause.
Well, $1 per ticket.
Well, if enough people go see it, that's quite a... quite a bit for the Fudge Cancer organization.
So it's the same story.
It's essentially the same story.
It's the same scenes.
And sanitized a bit.
Now,
but
I find
then
it
they'll
odd.
Joke. No, but then they'll cut back into him telling the story and the reactions to what's going on. And then it's the way that they construct the interstitial bit.
So how much percentage-wise of Once Upon a Deadpool had you already seen?
Well, I didn't remember specifically all that much of the original. So, to me, it was like you just kind of go in and you watch it through a very different lens and you just enjoy it. And then you go, oh, right. Okay, I remember that sort of happening in the first one. But they mock the same way that the franchise always mocks itself and mocks the superhero genre and the mutant genre. They play into that with these sort of plot devices that take you from one point to the next and to the same conclusion, essentially, as the original. But the stuff with Fred Savage is funny and self-mocking. And it's still not for little kids. This might be PG-13, the sanitized version, but it is still very much an older
kid. Well, I find it odd that to get probably a PG-13 rating, they took out the F words. But that's still a very hyper-violent film. Bullets go into skulls.
And even what they do is they bleep the wazoo out of things. And so it's just bleep, bleep, bleep all over the place. But that's fun. It's entertaining. It's not, it's just... The same way people would go.
It's the same movie you saw 7 months ago.
But people watch the same movies over again all the time. And so this is just giving it to you in a slightly different way and allows you to maybe take the teenagers who, when it was just a hard R, you were like, there's no way you're going to see this. Also, the new bits are at the very end because this is a Marvel movie. Technically, it's, a 20th Century Fox in association with Marvel, which makes it slightly different than the other Marvel movies, and they make a big joke out of that. But because it is, in essence, a Marvel movie, you need to stay and stay and stay through the end credits. And they make it kind of worth your while, but you are staying for, quite a while because every few minutes, you're like, okay, are they going to do something else in the end credits? And, are they going to do another little scene? Because you're always going to be... It's the Marvel way. You're always going to be putting these bonus scenes in at the end. And then at the very, 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 very end, there's a little homage to Stan Lee. And so they throw in a couple tidbits and throw you a few bones so that if you are a fan of Deadpool, this is just another way to rewatch a film that you might have enjoyed, and this way you can enjoy it with the teenagers who might be upset that you didn't take them to the R-rated version.
If I was going to take a teenager to the movies this weekend, I would take him to Bennis Back or Vox Lux over
but
you Once Upon
see,
a Deadpool.
That's because you didn't see
I've
Once
seen it. I've
but,
seen it.
But it's
I
not
saw Deadpool 2. I've seen the movie. In fact, I've seen the original version of
it. But that's what I'm saying is this is just a...
It's got a couple different
jokes. It's got
jokes,
a couple of different
And they
jokes.
Took out the swearing. Yeah. No, I've seen this movie.
So throw a buck to the fudge cancer people.
And I would also take them to our next film, which is Japanese. It's in Japanese. It's set in Japan. And it won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. What teenager would not want to go to his friends the next day and say, guess what? I saw the Cannes Film Festival Palme d'Or winner.
Yeah, I don't know what kind of teenager you're going to be raising, but I feel for the boy.
I'm talking about Shoplifters, and that's the new Hirokazu Koreeda. We've talked about him before. 2 years ago, we saw After the Storm, another film about a family. Before that, I saw Like Father, Like Son. In 2013, another film about a family. And in 2004, I saw Nobody Knows, another ad hoc family film. So he's got a type. Hirokazu Koreeda has a type. And this is not a standard family. This is a patchwork quilt, and I'm actually not sure who is technically related to whom type of family. It's a family of petty criminals. They actually live off of grandma's meager government check, but they subsist day to day kind of on petty scams and shoplifting. And even though they're dirt poor, they're happy. They're happy. Grandma's the matriarch. There's a married couple. I believe they are married. And they have a son who I don't think is related to them. There's another daughter over here. I'm not quite sure who she's related to.
I don't know what her relation was.
And they find a little girl freezing to death on a balcony. You can tell she's abused. She's neglected. And they have nothing, but they bring her into their family and treat her like one of them. And she becomes one of them. And she's happy as a clam, happy she's ever been in her life. And it makes Shoplifters just this uplifting, wonderful foreign film, and it's being nominated for everything. It's already nominated for a Golden Globe Best Foreign Film. It was nominated for the Washington D.C. Film Critics Best Foreign Film. It will be it's Japan's entry for Best Foreign Film. It will be nominated. It won the top prize at Cannes, which means it beat out Burning. It beat out Black Klansman. I mean, that's a big deal to win that award. I enjoyed it so much. Yes, it's kind of a downer ending. I remember
you
said
that. Yeah, I was like, you said uplifting, and I'm like,
it is. It is uplifting.
I suppose it's effective.
They're taking care of each other.
They are. It's a very affecting movie. Like, it sticks with you quite a bit, but I didn't feel it. To me, it was a bit of, it's a downer in the end. You can't really give much away. You got to sort of figure it out as the movie progresses. But it gets under your skin. It really does. It just, you're rooting for this family. You're rooting for the little girl who's just cute as a button. But then it takes some very interesting turns.
It's realism. Like,
this
is probably what would happen.
And the style and the tone are very reminiscent of that other one, After the Storm, which was the fact that I can even refer to having seen another Hirokazu Koreeda film is in and of itself kind of an amazing little miracle.
I think it's wonderful.
I know, because I do think that you probably made me watch After the Storm, and
actually,
I did enjoy
it. Actually, I remember you liked it more than I did.
I did like it, and so this has actually some of the same actors in it.
Many of them.
So I was kind of like, wait a minute, I almost felt like we were watching a variation of these
people. He uses the same actors over and over again. He's kind of like a Tarantino that way, or a Coen Brothers, and I wanted to point out that the grandma, Kieran Kiki, she just died in real life. She died in September, and she'd been on all those films I just mentioned. She was in all of those films. She was very good.
Yeah, but this is still, Shoplifters is still primarily for the arty crowd, but for the mainstream folks who like that occasional foreign flick, this is one that I think is a worthy watch.
I think it's more relatable. When you talk about the Rack and Stack, the best foreign films that people are talking about this year, Shoplifters is more relatable, I think, than Burning. The Korean film that I put in my top five. Actually, I put it was my number one film of the year for Wafka.
and maybe one other person.
I think a couple other people had that on there. But I think Shoplifters is a little bit more relatable to mainstream audiences. There's some tough stuff towards the end. I think I would classify it a lot as a feel-good movie.
Certainly, in the end, when you think back on it, you do get that. And you kind of are wondering if only, certain things were different. what would happen with this family. And it's definitely, I actually think I like it better than Roma, which is getting all the attention for best foreign film, possibly even being into the regular film category. And to me, this one, I really enjoyed Shoplifters more than Roma. And
the fact that you're making that argument, it sends me over the moon. I love that you're saying, I really enjoyed this art house Japanese film over this art house Mexico film.
Exactly.
And I was like, oh, Hannah, you're welcome. Let me open the door. Step on in.
That's right. You're wrong about Once Upon a Deadpool. You're wrong about Ben is Back. And you're wrong about Box Lux. But when it comes to Shoplifters, I think I'm there with you.
Let's talk about these arty foreign films and really rack and stack them together. This is perfect.
There you go.
I love it. Now for something completely different. We're going to end on a documentary, and it was a crowd pleaser at this year's AFI Docs. Everyone who saw it just laughed long, a lot of smiles, and it's because we all learned something we didn't know. I did not know what an industrial musical was. So, Hannah, what is an industrial musical?
It was this whole sort of hidden industry, I guess really primarily in the 60s and 70s, where all these companies, for their national conventions, their annual conventions, their regional conventions, their sales conventions, would actually hire these musical theater people to put on these shows for these live shows for their employees. And it was this whole sort of, it was this industry of industrial musicals, and they were really fun. And if you just took the music itself, and you sort of strip the lyrics and put in more standard traditional lyrics, you would have like Broadway musicals. But instead, you get musicals relating to bathrooms, cars, drugs, Tupperware. I mean, it was fascinating to learn about all these musicals that existed on film and on record, on albums from that era.
So we're talking about a documentary called Bathtubs Over Broadway, and it actually follows a main character called Steve Young. He's a writer for When It Was on the Air Late Night with David Letterman, and in his spare time sometimes he'd go to these vintage record store, and he just stumbled across this odd subgenre back in the corner of these industrial musical albums. And it turns out he wasn't alone. There's about, I don't know, probably only four other people.
A handful, yeah, at the most.
And they were competing for these very rare records. These records were not meant to be consumed by anybody else other than the crowd that was there. That's why you don't find them many places. They were for internal use only. Only. And then they tracked down two of the major ladies. That was in everybody's favorite one, which is My Bathroom. And they're singing, My Bathroom. A very catchy song. And they track them down. Pat Stanton, Janola, and Sandy Freeman. They're still around, and we find out, what were you doing back then to get cast in this? And then they track down Sid Siegel, the guy who wrote My Bathroom. And they interview, to make it more interesting, they get some famous faces that used to do industrial musicals, like Martin Short. They got Florence Henderson before she passed.
You saw pictures like Tony Randall was in some of these. I mean, they had actually, really talented people who made, it was good money. Basically it was like, okay, it's sort of like when you see how some of the really big stars do the perfume commercial over, or the coffee commercial overseas, because they can just make a lot of easy money. And
Bill Murray in Lost in Translation.
Yeah.
Make it Suntory time.
It is. And so that really was a way for it. It was a job. It was an industry, and it kept people employed.
And General Electric and Ford had money to spend.
Yes, and I don't think they have that kind of money. I don't think companies can get away anymore with spending that kind of money on like an annual conference. Now it would be like, how much did you spend on that Vegas bash?
Well, now they'll just hire a band or something to play a private show.
Or it's like the Beyonce thing this week.
Yeah, they just don't commission their own Broadway musical and take it seriously. They took it seriously. That's why some of these songs are really good.
They are very catchy. And the two women you mentioned, they were there after the AFI Doc screening of this and sang the song, and they were very funny. They still, they could remember these lyrics, And here it was, you know, was it 40 years later? And they could still kick it. And these, I mean, but I also, some of these lyrics would not fly in the Me Too movement.
The place, the bathroom, the place I dream, the place I cream.
I was like, oh no, like, this is so not right anymore.
I mean, you're actually watching her put on moisturizer when
yes,
she says it.
Yes, but at the same time, you just stop in your tracks. And
it got the biggest laugh.
It did.
And it's a funny movie. It's not... I'm not talking about the best five documentary. It's not hard hitting. It's just amusing.
Everybody left with a smile on their face after this one, and it's interesting. Sort of the same way you had, you know, we talked about like the film worker earlier this year, and so you got the one guy who's really heavily involved behind the scenes of helping make these masterpieces come to life, and with this one, Steve Young, and David Letterman was one of the executive producers on this film, but this is a documentary that's also, it's as much about Steve Young and his passion for discovering this industry and this, all these industrial musicals, and then being like the sole person responsible for preserving the legacy of what these things were and bringing to light to the average person that these things existed. And so you watch it and, you know, a part of you is just like, oh man, dude, get a life. And then the other part of you is like, wow, if it wasn't for you and your passion for this particular quirky genre, then the rest of us wouldn't know about it. And so it's sort of a twofer. You're getting Steve Young's story as the linchpin for sharing all these great little tidbits, because he had to go and find them. But you also are getting that sort of sneak peek into what makes someone tick and how he single-handedly really did manage to find a way to bring these pieces all together and create this documentary that's just really fun to watch. Anybody who likes Broadway musicals, is there something flying overhead? Anyone who likes Broadway musicals or movie musicals, this is just a fun documentary to watch.
No, that's a good way to put it. At first, if you just read about it, it doesn't sound relatable. Why would I want to watch something about something called industrial musicals? But no, it's about, for any fans of musicals or Broadway, the crossover is there, and it's so good.
Yeah.
All right, quick recap on this hodgepodge of an episode. We started way back there with Vox Lux. I think a showcase for Natalie Portman, a wonderful experiment, which I believe succeeds on all counts. I think it's an amazing film.
I think experiment is the key word here, and it will work for some people and not so much for others, but it is interesting.
Business Back had me for a while until it switched tracks. It did for a while feel just, oh no, another drug addict movie for the holidays. I did prefer Beautiful Boy, but Julia Roberts is the reason to go.
Lucas Hedges and Julia Roberts together are just very watchable. They are the reason to go. I give this one the slight edge over Beautiful Boy. I just think it's a little more accessible to watch.
I'm still perplexed over the entire concept of Once Upon a Deadpool. Go see something you haven't seen before.
I'm okay with that. I think this will come out probably in its Once Upon a Deadpool will probably move over and be available in other formats. So unless you want to kick in that buck for charity, you can wait and just watch it later.
Shoplifters is the best film of the week. It will be talked about from now through the Oscars in every conversation. It's about a family you do want to get to know that looks out for each other, and it's just a wonderful film.
I liked it. It gets a little sad, but it's poignant. I don't agree that it's the best film of the week. I think it's the best foreign film of the week. But I still think that it's going to be hard to really sneak into the conversation. I'm glad it'll be out there, hopefully, for the for Oscar season. But it really is still a really good pick for the foreign film crowd.
Bathtubs Over Broadway is the best documentary of the week.
It is.
It's quirky, it's funny, and the songs will stay in your head.
That's right. We're going to be singing My Bathroom for many years to come.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to this You Don't Know What You're Going to Get episode of the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.